We're going to start with Catherine, and I'm going to do her bio first, and I'll do Riley's before he speaks. Catherine Hayhoe, you may know her from the Texas Tech Conference. She's an atmospheric scientist who is able to talk to a lot of people because she's also a devout Christian. And that's allowed her to carry the message to quarters not necessarily open initially to the idea of climate change and doing something about it. She runs the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech, and she conducts climate impact assessments of cities and towns and all kinds of other jurisdictions. And she's been a lead author for National Climate Assessment. Sorry. Okay. Catherine, take it away.
Thank you. We know this one works, so I'll stick with this one. Oh, okay, perfect. So it is a little ironic that in a session about social science, the first person to speak up is a physical scientist. I prefer to call it physical science or natural sciences if you include life, because calling it hard sciences suggests that social science isn't hard. And honestly, I think that social science is a whole new can of worms. Trying to understand the physical environment, the cosmology of the universe, the DNA of our genetics, pales into insignificance in terms of complexity when you try to understand what goes on inside the human mind. Part of which is probably because sometimes we can't even describe it. So I'm going to start off by briefly talking about what the natural sciences can give us. I know we just had a very long plenary session on that topic, but if you had to sum up the plenary into, 3 minutes, this is what we know from the natural sciences. The first thing natural science can tell us is that climate is changing. Whether we are looking at melting ice, earlier cherry blossoms, increased risk of drought, stronger hurricanes, melting permafrost, or record-setting heat waves, all around the world we know that there are tens of thousands of physical and biological indicators of a changing climate. And that is what natural science can tell us. Natural science can also tell us a second thing that is very important, and that is that for the first time in the long history of our planet, the changes we're seeing are not natural cycles, they are not just the weather, they are not just the sun. As this very nice Bloomberg graphic showed us this past year, if our climate were changing due to natural factors, it would be moving in a very different direction than it is today. And in fact, if you look over a longer period of time, this is a figure I made looking at the last 6,000 years, you see that our temperature used to be on a long, slow cooling trend until something happened. So what we know today is that if it were not for our soaring greenhouse gas emissions, the planet would be cooling, and the next thing on our geologic horizon would be another ice age, which again is not good either. But we're heading so far in the other direction that we have indefinitely postponed the likelihood of another ice age. The third thing science can tell us, natural science, is that our choices matter. When we look at future carbon emissions that depend on the choices we make, primarily related to energy, those two different trajectories have radically different impacts on our planet. And this is what I spend a lot of my time unpacking for state and federal agencies and for individual cities and towns around the country. Just to give you one very brief example of how this matters, if you look at the average number of days per year over 100 degrees, this is what they look like historically. If we follow the lower pathway, this is what they will look like before end of century. And if we follow the higher pathway, this is what they will look like. And this is what the physical sciences can tell us. We also know, if you pay attention to surveys, that the public believes that scientists are about half and half on the topic of climate change. But science can also tell us that if you not only survey climate scientists, but if you survey the scientific literature, the overwhelming majority of climate scientists agree not only that humans are affecting climate, but that we are the primary reason why climate is warming today. And science can tell us one more thing, and this is starting to dip our toes into the waters of social science here, but this is really, I believe, on the bridge between natural and social sciences. Naomi Oreskes and her team recognized that we climate scientists are often accused of being alarmist. I've even been told by well-meaning colleagues in different fields, you know, Catherine, if you could just tell your colleagues to tone it down. You know, if you just weren't so alarming, I think people would believe you more. But Naomi and her colleagues looked at 20 years of scientific projections and found that far from being alarming, the available evidence, and this is quoting from her paper on this topic, suggests that we've been conservative in our impacts. Conservative to the point where, yes, scientists are biased towards cautious estimates. So to such an extent that they coined a syndrome called ESLD. We climate scientists are guilty of erring on the side of least drama, not most. This is what the natural science can tell us. And so in celebration of this moment, I'm incorporating my very first GIF ever. You see what he's about to do. He's about to drop the mic and walk away. This is really the feeling of most climate scientists today. We have told you everything you need to know to make a good decision. We are done. And so if people were rational actors, as we are optimistically and euphemistically referred to in some social sciences, if we were rational actors, what would we do when confronted with this information? We would say, oh no, let's do something about it. But instead, we have results like this Gallup poll, which has asked people if the seriousness of global warming is exaggerated, correct, or underestimated. And if you look at the last 6 years, you see that we have steady levels of about 40 to 48% of the United States thinking that the seriousness of this issue is exaggerated. In other words, that we're alarmists. If you look at Bob Brule's work, you see that the number of people who are worried has gone down. If you look at Max Boykoff's work, you see that media coverage of climate change went up, went down, and then has been slowly rising, but is not even back to what it used to be back in, you know, 10 years ago or less. If you look at the work of the Union of Concerned Scientists, I'm kind of taking you of a tour here through some of the low parts of social science, you see that a lot of the coverage on national networks on the topic of climate change is flat out misleading. In other words, they're offering false information. Why was CNN so misleading in 2013? It's because every time I got a phone call from them, it was to go head-to-head against somebody who didn't think climate change was real. I said no. So faced with this information, us rational actors, us cold, hard scientists, think, oh, well, we know why this is. It's because people don't have enough information. If people just had more information, they would know what to do about it. So you, journalists, need to write more about it with correct information. Well, here's why I love social science. Dan Kahan, who some of you probably know, wrote a paper in Science that said public apathy over climate change is often attributed to a deficit in comprehension. People know too little science to understand it. And if this is true, then what should our response be? This session is about social science and the IPCC. Well, if we don't know enough, then clearly the 1990 IPCC reports were insufficient. So we can write a new set in 92 and 94, but maybe those didn't get good enough circulation, so let's do it again in 95. But we have to update it with some new papers in 2001, and then there's even more information people need to know by 2007, and then, of course, there's more information today. Let's write another report. Maybe international reports are suspicious, so let's write national climate assessments. Or maybe those aren't objective enough, so we could also do national academy reports, and another one, and yet another one. This is what we do if people are rational actors who react to information in a sensible way. But here's what Dan's study found. This is the beauty of social science. We tested this and found no support, no support at all. People with the highest degree of science literacy were not the most concerned about climate change. Rather, they were the ones among whom cultural polarization was greatest. So more information is not the answer. So then you might say, okay, but I know what the problem is. And this relates to what Christy was talking about with my intro. We know what the problem is because every time we turn on C-SPAN, or we go to our local favorite media, or we're looking for interesting quotes to write about, what do we see? We see people telling us, elected officials, I might add, telling us, well, The climate has been changing as long as God created it. And it will continue to change because of the way God created it. And the earth will end only when God declares it will be over. And no presentation in Oklahoma would be complete without this quote. Yes. The arrogance of people to think that we little tiny human beings could change what God is doing to climate. This past year, Public Religion International came out with a poll that measured climate change concern by religious affiliation. And sure enough, what do you find? At the very bottom of the pack, you find white Catholics and white evangelical Protestants. Right above them, you find white mainline Protestants. Up at the top, you find Hispanic Catholics, though. So looking at this, people could say, well, clearly, the problem is religion. It's very specifically Christianity. And it isn't just about climate. I'm happy to announce that as of yesterday, people's objections have extended to the entire field of meteorology, in case you missed it yesterday. Please don't write about it, though. This does not deserve writing attention. So, does Christianity equal climate denial? This is why we need social science. Because what social science tells us, and this is the work of John Evans, isn't it nice just seeing the pictures of the people rather than their names? It's more personable. You know, we're all human. John tested for this. He said, controlling for demographic properties shows that it's not going to church that causes this effect. Opinions are rooted in age, political conservatism, and the Republican Party. And when we look at the United States, we see that political polarization in the United States has gone like this over the past 20 years. So when we look at the social science, Bob Burley's work shows us that the information we get from people we trust, our thought leaders, and the economy have the largest level of concern. Why is that? It's because if we look at history, we see that climate change raises concerns. These are these rude Australians. You would never see a placard like this in the United States. Unless you were outside the National Weather Service yesterday. Climate solutions raise fears that resonate in the psyche of Americans all the way back to the American Revolution. How do we know this is true? Let's go back to our local authority. You probably saw how a few years ago, in an interview with Rachel Maddow, he said, "Do you realize I was actually on your side of this issue when I first heard about this?" Until when? Until I opened the Bible? Nope. Until I went to church? Nope. Until I found out how much it would cost. Galen Carey from the National Association of Evangelicals offers us this thought. He says, many evangelicals oppose action to slow climate, not on a religious basis, but politically, because they believe the government wants to what? Take away their freedom. So if it isn't a case of giving people information, what is a physical scientist to do? When I look at all of this, I think of this quote, one of the hardest things in life is deciding whether you should give up or try harder. Well, those of you who know me know that I do not give up. I do try harder. So I have developed a communication approach that I tried to explain to Citizens Climate Lobby this summer. So if you're interested in my communication approach in the face of these difficulties, it is here on YouTube. But what I want to do is I want to feed in now to my colleague Riley Dunlap's talk. Here's the IPCC. We have Working Group 1, which discusses the science of climate change in exhaustive detail. We have Working Group 2, which discusses the impacts of climate change on people and the planet. We have Working Group 3 that deals with energy, the economy, technology, and emissions. And these three work great. They are all we need to fix climate if we are robots. In other words, if we are purely rational actors who react in a logical way to information. But I have a news flash, which is probably not news to you, but it might be to the IPCC. Humans are not robots. We are not, by large, rational actors. We are very diverse people with very diverse views, values, opinions, biases, hopes, fears, and dreams. And so that is why we need the social science, because we could offer the best information in the world on the science of climate change, the impacts of climate change, and even on the solutions of climate change. But without understanding how that information interacts with people, it is not going to work. And so that's why this next presentation from my colleague Riley Dunlap is so important. Take it away, Riley.
Okay. Let me just do a quick introduction, so people know who you are.
Riley Dunlap is our resident sociologist. He's a professor of sociology at Oklahoma State University. And he was a founder of the field of environmental sociology. And there are a lot of these new fields cropping up that are really interesting, the different aspects of dealing with this. He's focused on climate change denial and political polarization. He's worked with Bob Brule, so a lot of you know, who's an SEJ stalwart. And together they've written a book, and it's Climate Change and Society. You all have, I think, a handout on that. It just came out like a couple weeks ago. And he would like to see, I believe, the IPCC and other organizations embrace social science much more than they have so far. Start thinking about who we are, what we want, what we've done to get ourselves into this situation, and what to do next.
Thank you. Actually, Catherine is just kind of she's taken all the sexy, jazzy stuff that folks like people like me do and already covered it. So let's just go ahead. So we hear all these calls for more social science in the IPCC. And historically, sociology was pretty much absent. So we're coming into this, but we do a variety of things in addition to the jazzy stuff that Catherine talked about. And we see one of our key roles is raising big questions. And we want to know why and how climate change, for example, has become such a conflictual issue. We want to know what kinds of conflicts are going to prevent dealing with it effectively, the kinds of things Catherine has illustrated. We know that the natural sciences have dominated climate change research, in part because the natural scientists played the key role. I mean, these were the founders. They're the ones that came up with all of this evidence and so forth. And yet, they quickly realized that it was due to human activities, but these human activities, as Catherine has noted, is kind of like a black box. You know, like, what do we do with this stuff? And let's look at this literally a black box. Here's a famous thing called the Bretherton model. Came out in a 1983 Earth Sciences report. It became sort of a framework for Earth science and then global environmental change, climate change. And as you can see, there's all these sophisticated things, the physical climate system, ocean dynamics, terrestrial ecosystems. And over here, well, rather than robots, we just have this kind of black box, this mysterious thing called humans. But the mounting evidence of the reality and significance of climate change, as Catherine illustrated so vividly with all these reports, more and more knowledge, basically illustrated that climate change is a people problem. The climate scientists knew quickly, burning more fossil fuels, more CO2 emissions is what's producing global warming. So humans are causing global warming. We consider it a problem because it's affecting the things that we people, human beings, value. And obviously alleviating the problem is going to require human actions. So all of a sudden, the natural scientists who had kind of put us in a black box are going, oh my gosh, we really need social science. We've got to bring social science in. And they are trying, but I'm a little bit concerned as a sociologist that it's a pretty narrow slice of what we call social science. Traditionally, economics has dominated. It's been the only social behavioral scientist that's really had a major role in the IPCC. And it looks like, kind of to my personal dismay, that it will have a greater role, because I see the new director of the IPCC is an economist. I personally regard that as worse than having a climate scientist. It's a major step backwards. But anyway, to try to deal with this, a number of the social sciences said, you know, we need to step forward. We need to show what we might offer. And so we find that, psychologists are technically behavioral scientists, but first the American Psychological Association, then the American Sociological Association, and finally the American Anthropological Association all created task forces to try to develop disciplinary perspectives, show what they could do when it came to climate change. The American Sociological Association set up this task force in sociology and global climate change. We ended up with a very big group, and rather than doing the typical thing of writing the report, sending it to the ASA office where it would get filed away, we decided to aim a little higher. And we developed a book perspective, sent it to Oxford University Press. To our surprise, they immediately liked it, took it. And so we created this ultimately huge group of people, 37, including Kathleen Tierney, who was here this morning. You saw in the plenary session. She was the lead author on a key chapter on climate change adaptation. So we have 13 chapters in this volume covering a lot of the key aspects of climate change, but especially those where there is existing sociological work. So we look at driving forces. We look, though, specifically at the role of corporations, something that doesn't get much attention, and then consumer behavior. And then we have the key issues of impacts with a heavy emphasis on inequality, a core sociological concern that we think is not given enough attention in much of the work on impacts. And then we have chapters on adaptation, mitigation, and then some of the things that sociologists do that other disciplines don't do. We look at civil society or social movements fighting for climate change, public opinion, we analyze that. I have a chapter in there on climate change denial and skepticism, which is my personal specialty. And then we have chapters focused more toward the discipline on sociological research methods. It turns out that sociologists have very good tools that add insight to issues like this. We want to know, is weather going to affect people's perceptions? It's a hot issue. A lot of people are doing work. But sociologists have these things called hierarchical regression models and so forth. So what we can do is control on things like census tracts or states, look at the actual climate conditions in those, and then look at their effects relative to party ideology and these other personal factors. And the evidence of whether or not extreme weather events are going to have a major effect, I think, is still out. The studies aren't so clear. But those are some of the things that we're doing in this overall book. But I just want to highlight some dominant thrust of it. Sociologists, we often take rather critical perspectives. And as we look at the existing efforts to bring social science into the IPCC, we see three major problems. But I'd like to talk about those. But anyway, first of all, there's still this problem of contributing to natural science agendas. We're asked to join in, but as Catherine hinted at, we have we're asked to do a fairly narrow thing. We'll talk about that. There's also a prevalence of individualistic analyses. Notice that everything Catherine talked about was based on individuals. And finally, there's a dominance of something that I hope will be new to most of you, what we call a post-political perspective. So let me try to outline these a bit more, clarify. So especially, not just the IPCC, but especially the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which has set up a committee on social science. They come in and they say, okay, we need social science. Here's what you can do. First of all, our overarching framework is something called coupled human and natural systems, CHANS. How many of you have heard of CHANS, that phrase? Because, okay, I'm surprised. It's kind of like a dominant perspective. Now, it's very useful. It's a way of looking at how humans modify the ecosystems and how those changes react back on humans. Very good, but it's narrow. It's restrictive. The second thing the USGRCP outlines is that we should help, just as Catherine illustrated, natural scientists to spread their message. We're brought in to help them convince the public that all this evidence requires some action to be taken. Now, the problem is, number one, you can read these yourself, but people, you get these very narrow agendas, and you're asking social scientists to come in and work on problems from perspectives that basically push away the bulk of sociological tools and other analytical tools. And secondly, when it comes to information, we literally are, it seems like they're calling on us, help us educate the public. We just need to really reach out and make our work more effective. You know, we've presented all this information and it's not leading to anything. What should we do? Those are clearly inadequate for sociologists and most other social scientists. But let's look at this individualistic analysis. And it's very, you know, Catherine did a superb job of lifting key insights. But the problem is that it seems like most people only think that social science focuses on these individuals. And the problem is, when you look at human behavior, individual behavior, it tends to be dominated by economics and psychology. We get these rational actor models, but we also get in psychology more open-minded, more realistic than economics, but we still get this emphasis on individuals and individual actors. And psychologists are sensitive to how groups and larger contexts affect individuals, more so, I think, than economists. But nonetheless, that line of thinking that it's all about individuals is very attractive because it fits in with our individualistic culture. We are the most individualistic nation in the world. I mean, we're like three standard deviations out from collectivism. There's some work came out, some psychologists have recently created some waves. They had a one-page article in Nature on how almost all of psychology is based on studies of weird people. Weird, white, educated, industrial, rich, developed nations. And if you look at those studies, 70% are based on undergrads, but 90-some-odd percent. And so this idea of individualistic analysis is just sort of built into psych, and it's certainly built in to econ, but it flourishes in our culture as well. But focusing on individuals leads, well, you saw that quote. So where do sociologists come in? Well, we do things like this. We do study individuals. In fact, Bob Brule, who I should have pointed out is co-editor of the book, I also study public opinion. I work with Gallup. I publish pieces on ideological and partisan polarization. Work along those lines, skepticism. We do a lot of work like that, but in addition, sociologists emphasize the roles of organizations, institutions, nation states, culture, these macro forces. Sociologists, for example, in material in the book, focus on the impact of population and growth, economic growth on greenhouse gas emissions. Also look at things like urbanization, democratization, how these affect national levels. The role of corporations in both producing greenhouse gas emissions and especially inhibiting action. You would think that people would talk about corporations, but no, it's individuals. The roles of culture and advertising and leading to high carbon lifestyles, and of course, social barriers to effective mitigation and adaptation. There are a lot of structural conditions that affect us. Individuals are not just free to go about their lives and make all these choices. Let's get to this interesting, to me, the most interesting. Came across this concept, comes out of Northern Europe, but the IPCC, the National Academy of Sciences, certainly the US Global Change Research Program, they adopt what's coming to be called a, quote, post-political frame, or perspective. Basically, the assumption, although it tends to be more implicit, is that everyone agrees that climate change is a threat. We got to deal with climate change. But it ignores the conflictual nature of the issue. When you take this post-political frame and you meld it with our dominant individualistic ideology, which is basically hegemonic in the US, especially these days, you get this sense in which, oh, climate change is a problem. There's this amorphous humanity out there, and they're just producing too much carbon. And what we see is that basically carbon, CO2 emissions, that's the enemy. That's what we got to defeat. We'll come up with new technologies, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have to really look at major social change. So I like this quote from a couple of, I think they're Brits. What one opposes are not necessarily specific actions or actors, but it's CO2 emissions as such. But what you're opposing is something that we're all implicated in. So one of your most hallowed, or I assume esteemed, colleagues sort of captured this some time ago, Andy Revkin. And we grew up in the 20th century where everything about the environment was either woe is me or shame on you. It's all coming undone and it's your fault. This is so antiquated when you look at a problem like climate change, where there is no who done it. We all done it. And early on, in the early days of environmentalism, there was a famous Pogo cartoon. How did it go, Seth? The enemy is us. It's us. So, you know, the implication of this frame, just stop and look. You, me, Rex Tillerson, who runs ExxonMobil, and especially the Koch brothers, we're just all in this together. We're all equally responsible. We all drive cars, use electricity. Hey, because if you focus on individual behavior, these things go together, all individuals are the same. Well, Donald Trump uses a little more CO2 with his private helicopter, et cetera. Okay. So the post-political frame has these very significant political advantages. What it does by pointing to individuals and assuming that everyone wants to reduce carbon emissions is to deflect attention from the structural roots of climate change. It limits political action in favor of consensual approaches. So we're back to, let's get individuals to drive less, to install solar, to do all these kinds of things. Let's not focus on corporations. So it really hinders attention to the sources. How many of you saw the piece put out by a guy named Heedy? I think I forgot who's the affiliated. He identified, I believe it was 70 major entities, primarily huge corporations, that were responsible for a majority of all CO2 emissions historically. 70. It might have included some nation states. So think about that. We're talking about individuals, and yet we can identify 70 entities. And Obama recently came out with this great thing. He's going to executive order. Let's bring in more rationality, behavioral science, behavioral economics and psychology in decision making. That's very good, but the emphasis on Sustine's behavioral nudges. Notice we're always nudging individuals. I think if we nudged corporations, it would be a little better. So the post-political frame, you think, why in the world would we even, why am I talking about this? It does come from Northern Europe, and it gained credibility there because some of those countries have been real trendsetters, but it's utterly irrelevant in the USA. And again, Catherine stole my thunder, but I had, you know, the work we do when we write about climate change denial, we say it's climate change or global warming, especially here in Oklahoma, it's joining God, gays, guns, abortion, and anti-evolution. I mean, that is part of conservative identity. To say that, to assume or adopt policies and perspectives that ignore this incredibly political nature of climate change is just simply nonsensical. So a critical contribution of sociological work is to highlight the nature and sources of conflict. And we focus sometimes on economic interests like fossil fuels, other times on this market fundamentalism, and that's the key. These come from often different sources, but they complement and interact, almost. So the last key theme of the book is something called public sociology. So sociologists have long served as commentators and critics and so forth, but in the recent just a little over a decade, it's become a key theme, this notion of public sociology. The president, ASA president, his theme talked about we need to engage publics beyond the academy in dialogue about matters of political and moral concern. So a public sociology of climate change clarifies the causes, how they're interwoven into the social, political, and economic order. It opens up new perspectives. We're hoping our book helps do that. And our goal is to expand the public and democratic dialogue on climate change. We have this near hegemonic notion in our society that things, the economic system is just the way it is. And we can't think outside that box. So it's not just individuals, but we can't imagine anything outside our current system. And I'm not a postmodernist, but I like that bottom quote is very famous by a leading postmodernist. And I think it captures the limitations of our mindsets in the US, especially at present. Next. But if you can't imagine the end of capitalism, let's just stop and think. How many have read Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything? All right. To see the action that's generating, you know, she's got movies, groups, marches, things going on, and of course now the Pope. I think that we need to think outside the box. We should stop focusing only on individuals. We should stop thinking that the current political economic system is here forever. It's totally non-malleable, and we need to move on. So my own personal thing, when someone says, if you want to deal with climate change, what should you do? One, fight voter suppression. Two, get all those Bill McKibben 350 young people out there marching to sign up and register to vote. And three, vote for people who will change. I don't think we're going to make very much progress just trying to change individuals' behaviors. We're going to have to change the political system. Thank you.
Seth?
I asked for a show of hands.
Okay. In terms of, especially Riley, in what you just finished up with, and talking about voting for change and even the Pope's Laudato Si, which also was an indictment on capitalism and greed. Is there a fear that this type of message sort of plays into the calling cards of the community of those who reject mainstream science? You know, they're just saying you're nothing but socialists, and this is all a redistribution of the wealth.
Is this working? Okay. Yeah, certainly that is. I mean, if you go to Mark Morano's Climate Depot, for example, anytime someone, you know, Naomi Klein, yeah, see, we told you it's all about capitalism. But here's the point. They're against you, us, all the time. I mean, they're not going to change. You don't have to worry about them. They've reached their cadre of followers, just like the Fox News. I mean, all this talk, I see so many people talk about, we just got to develop better messages for conservatives. No, you better develop better messages for young people and get them active and so forth. So I think they're a lost cause, and just, you know, the fact that they're going to label us as radicals or something, they've already done that. So what else is it going to hurt? You know, you say, well, it's going to turn off some people in the middle. I don't know. What is Bernie Sanders? Has he turned off people? He's a self-avowed socialist.
Catherine, you have changed some narratives, and memorably back in 2005 when we met in Austin, Texas, Bill Moyers said the metaphor that I want to use is the ark, and I use that metaphor with religious people or conservative people, and we're on, you know, we're building an ark here.
So. Ark with a K, not a C. So I take heart from the fact that if you look at the six Americas of global warming, if you are not familiar with that, you need to be. It's a great market segmentation tool developed by Tony Lazarowitz and Ed Maybach, divides everybody in the United States into six groups based on their perspective on climate change. And what I find most heartening about that research is that the people who we hear the most from at the tails of the distribution, people who are either alarmed or dismissive, are extremely small parts of the population. The dismissive average around 10% of the population. Now, granted, they have very loud voices. We hear about them a lot. Sometimes they are given much more disproportionate time in the media than otherwise because it's more interesting to hear people argue. But when I speak, I'm not talking to the 10% who are dismissive. And even here in Oklahoma and in Texas where I live, yes, there's more than 10%, but they're not half of the population. Far more people are doubtful, which means the door is still open to have a discussion. Even more people are either disengaged or cautious. And so, as Riley just said, those are the people that we need to be talking with and working with and affecting institutional change with, because that represents the vast proportion of people in this country. For too long, the tip of the tail has been wagging the entire dog. And it's time for the dog to actually decide which direction it takes.
Great.
The one of the fascinating things that, oh, I'm sorry. Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade. One of the fascinating things about the Pope as a communicator is, and it's something that Seth's going to be doing for us on Sunday morning, is, you know, the role of religion as a form of environmental communication. And I was just wondering, you know, the idea of climate change, the science of climate change is, you know, has penetrated the school system. But are there other institutions other than religion where you see have the potential to, because religion speaks to a lot of people, as Catherine knows, from evangelicals and so forth. But are there other major institutions you can identify that would take this beyond the political realm and kind of penetrate the mainstream in terms of as a form of communication to get the message through?
I think about the only institution that can reach such a sizable audience is education, including higher education. And, you know, that we know our school systems talk about these things. But, of course, that's become a big battleground because the Koch brothers and ALEC and so forth are, you know, constantly trying to get states to pass legislation to teach climate change like evolution is, you know, both sides of the issue and so forth. So I think one has to fight hard to win those battles. But I think education, certainly higher education, can play a role. And there's a lot of talk about the need for faculty, professors in the academy to speak out, you know, be public intellectuals, so to speak.
I would also say that I think that that's exactly where we need to be working. What I try to do is I never try to start anything myself or be part of a group that's starting something from scratch. I try to work with something that already exists. So whether it's an association of ski industries, whether it is a group for, you know, moms of young children, any type of group that already exists, whether it's for hunters, Chamber of Commerce, Rotarians, working within existing groups is key because they already have a large constituency, they already have a coherent set of values, and they already have that connection, which is what we are lacking, is the connection literally between our head and our heart, which, you know, somebody said is the furthest distance in the universe.
Great.
Oops, sorry, Ronnie.
Can I just add one thing, one other possible institution? You know, I don't like to use words like capitalism and so forth. It kind of conjures up this monolithic notion. I mean, business interests are very diverse. And interestingly, the insurance industry has been one of the leaders in dealing with climate change. So I would think that another institution would be the more progressive groups. And we've seen various firms drop out of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has led this really extreme attack on climate change and push climate change denial and so forth. So I think reaching various business groups that have perhaps material interest to look after, that's another way. There's some, you know, there's a lot of talk about how effective social responsible business, or what is it called, socially responsible corporations are, but I think these kind of investor campaigns and all those kinds of efforts, that's another, you know, what I was saying before, nudging corporations, not individuals. So I think those efforts are worthwhile. I honestly am not up on that, so I can't answer.
I forgot to mention the rules. Maybe you all know, but SEJ members and working journalists first and no speeches. Not that anybody's done that yet, but Lana, I saw your hand up.
You've got to raise your hand so I can. Thank you. Lana Straub, freelance journalist from West Texas, which are climate, well, I won't say what they think about climate science there. But you're talking about education. One of the things that they've done at the Texas Education Agency I just heard about is they put some homeschooling parents on the curriculum committee. And they're putting, you know, side by side with science, the non-science. So how do we reach those parents?
Well,
those people?
I mean, one of the organizations that I really appreciate is an organization that has a very neutral name. It's called the American Scientific Affiliation. I think it's deliberately neutral. You'd never know what it was. It's an organization of scientists who are Christians, Catholic, Protestant. And they have ties to the homeschooling organizations. And so I really applaud what they do because they are trying to work directly with these organizations, working with people who, you know, who are homeschooled themselves, who come from that community, but who understand science to try to work from the inside. And that's another example of working with groups internally rather than externally, because it's like if you can push together in the same direction, you can get it done. But the trick, not, I should never use that word, we learned that during the email issue. Yeah, never use trick. The challenge is that it depends so much on personal communications, right? So, or personal relationships. So it really is about connecting with people, recognizing that we have the same priorities and values, and then working together to go somewhere. And that's so tough because it's a lot easier to point fingers and to say, you know, you idiot, why would you say that? I'm going to fight you tooth and nail. It's easier to say that initially, but we get less distance on it in the long run.
Clint. Hi, Clint Wilder with Clean Edge. So there's one demographic group where the dismissives is much higher than 10%, and that's the United States Congress.
Yeah.
Both sides, both houses. So is that, and Professor Dunlap, I like what you said about number one, fight voter suppression, if you want to fight climate change denial. But with Congress, is this just a matter of Koch brothers' campaign contributions, or is there a social science component there?
Well, I think there are a lot of political science analyses of the growing polarization. You know, Catherine illustrated from the Pew surveys, and we have reached a stage of unprecedented polarization. And it really, I mean, it took off on steroids with 2010, the Tea Party coming in. And it's just a hard thing to talk about. I think, you know, all of the factors, certainly the Koch brothers, but fossil fuels, Paul Krugman had a great essay a couple days ago. He said the Republican Party is fossilized. And he literally meant it. I mean, they get so much fossil fuel money. So there's financial interest, but it's the ideological. When you bring in these Tea Party folks, these market fundamentalists, I mean, basically, when you elect people to Congress who hate government and are convinced that government can't work, then they come into office and they do their best to demonstrate that government can't work. And yeah, and so it's quite extreme, and I would... How many of you are familiar with that book? It's even worse than you think. I think Mann and Ornstein, because it's a famous book. These are two really mainstream, kind of neutral commentators, but they came out with a book and said the Republican Party's gone off the deep end. I mean this, and I mean Mann. No, Ornstein works at the American Enterprise Institute, and one of my messages to you folks is I'm still so sad about Fed, false equivalence disease. I'm just appalled that, you know, a Rick Perry or someone can come on. Now, these guys can come on and say utter nonsense and get away with it. And the media just don't seem to do their job and stand up. So I've rambled a bit here, but there's good political science work on polarization. And Ed Saul, who writes in the New York Times, had a piece recently on that. So I think it's a lot of money, and frankly, people don't, okay, so don't quote me on this, but I mean, the way all this coalesced into the anti-Obama thing, I mean, everything, let's face it, from, oh my God, a black man in the White House, to fossil fuel interests, to all of these, you know, intense funding, it's just created an unprecedented situation. But what concerns me is we have a Congress that literally denies reality. And that's not effective.
I would just add, though, that I think our politicians are a special case. We have to be careful not to assume they believe everything they're saying. A couple of years ago, those of you who don't know should be very aware that this meeting is here because of our South Central Climate Science Center. Our director is right back there, Kim, and she is a wonderful director, and Renee is also there too. These are two of the key people who brought us here today, and they hold these amazing meetings every year where we bring together climate researchers from all around the South Central region. So a couple of years ago, one of our colleagues was on their way back to, I think it was Louisiana, from our Climate Science Center meeting. And in the airplane, he was sitting beside a congressman from Texas who shall remain nameless. But it is a congressman who has very frequently and outspokenly voiced opinions on climate change along the lines of, you know, the hoaxes, the not real, the natural cycles. In fact, I have actually seen him do it in person. Sitting beside that man, the congressman said, oh, well, so you know, what were you doing? And so my colleague kind of cleared his throat and said, well, I was at a Climate Science Center meeting. And much to his shock, the politician said to him, climate change, that's such an important issue. You know, we really got to fix it. And my colleague's like, what? So how many people, if they took the Six Americas test in complete anonymity, would end up really, truly in the dismissive group? Very few. I would be willing to bet most of our politicians would end up in the cautious group, and a few might actually shock us by being in the concern group. But they're a lot more concerned about something else. Exactly, re-election. And that trumps concern about climate every time we have this short election cycle. I mean, maybe the solution is increasing the election cycle to 20 years. There's an idea.
I'm going to invoke moderator's privilege and ask about capitalism, which has been mentioned but not probed deeply here. My question to Catherine is whether there are things that natural scientists can do to make capitalism work better for the climate. While you're thinking about that, my question for you, Riley, will be, is there a way to reframe capitalism is the problem and must be changed so that it works better?
I mean, clearly using the word capitalism is, you know, attracts a lot of attention, and you're going to get bad press no matter what you say from somewhere. But I think, how many of you are familiar with Gus Speth? This is a guy, Jimmy Carter's director of environmental quality, that founded the World Resources Institute, dean of Yale's School of Environment and Forestry and Environmental Studies. I mean, it's establishment as it comes. And had I had, I was going to put a quote from him. I mean, he says, most of the major ecological problems we have today stem from the current form of capitalism. He's not a radical. He's not a Marxist. But then he goes on to say, there are things that we can do. We can modify. We can become more rational, you know, internalizing the externalities, et cetera, as the economists like to tell us. And he said, these changes need to be made, whether that's going to result in some kind of new system or just a new form of capitalism, a more eco-friendly form. You know, that it's kind of a matter of definition in part, and it's a matter of degree. So I don't see any environmentalist really playing the watermelon role. That's what, you know, you've all heard, they're green on the outside, but they're red on the inside. I see very little of that. But we just need to do some fundamental changes. And again, let's stop and think what's happened since the 80s. I mean, this just dramatic shift of, we call it neoliberalism, which is really not fair to Hayek and von Mises. They at least recognized a role for government, these Austrian economists. But this notion that all government regulations are bad by definition, we've just gone way, way off. So I think we can do a lot with the economy without having any kind of major economic revolution.
I would agree, and I think that there are two very tangible things that can be done within the frame of capitalism. The first one is embodied by Elon Musk. He is making energy cool. He's making it into the new iPhone that everybody wants. I mean, who doesn't want a $3,500 battery pack in their house that can save all the electricity that they need? Who doesn't want, you know, a car that you can just plug in that actually has like acceleration and torque and all those things that people talk about when they talk about cars? So technology is a huge way that we can change our energy consumption, using market forces if it is attractive enough and affordable enough. But then the second way to use a market is through pricing, carbon pricing. And so one of the most frequent questions I get is, well, if you could do one thing to fix climate, what would it be? And with the disclaimer that I am a physical scientist, I'm not an economist, I'm not a social scientist, but if I could wave a magic wand or, you know, open the bottle in that genie and get one wish, it would be for a price on carbon. Because I feel like then the market could actually correct itself if it were the right price. Now don't let's get started about what the right price is, because that is out of my bailiwick. But I think there are definitely things that can be done within the current system. So in that sense, I think that the discussion of, well, we have to completely get rid of capitalism is like, good luck. It's kind of similar to the argument I often hear in Christian circles, which is, we just have to get everybody to agree with science. And then we can agree on climate change. It's like, oh, so you think you can get everybody to agree on the age of the universe and evolution and creation within the handful of years we need to act on climate? Good luck. It's been 400 years already. What makes you think you can accomplish it in four? So we have to be practical about what we can achieve given the system we're in, and we have to be practical about the fact that climate change is extremely urgent, and every year that goes by without really solid, massive, major steps being taken is another year that we are never going to get back. So,
how about, can I go in the middle or the back, because I've been focusing on the front? And I would add fossil fuel subsidies to that list myself. We are still subsidizing fossil fuels.
Anybody back here? Okay.
Sam Shramsky, researcher and freelancer. So one of the things that the panelists have been discussing is this issue of polarization. And the internet certainly doesn't make that any better. And so a lot of their incriminations have been directed at the media. But actually, frankly, a lot of this polarization that we're seeing is demonstrated on social media or in the vast landscape of the internet. So that's one thing that we have as an issue, that is an issue like climate change that's difficult to address. But on the other hand, researchers like Dan Kahan and other social psychologists and sociologists are telling us that one of the primary ways of disseminating information and media content is through elite cues, right? through people that other people trust. So if you're in Oklahoma, if you're in rural Oklahoma, have a rural Oklahoman address an issue in a manner that's more conducive to the recipient. So my question is, how do we deal with both these issues? We have this diverse landscape, totally atomized on the internet, where people can believe anything they find. How do we marry that with this idea that we need elite cues and persons that disseminate information from the same communities that these people come from?
You're totally right. I mean, social media is where the most vicious polarization exists today. And again, to kind of reiterate the point that I think Tom first brought up, again, the solution is to be embedding in the networks and organizations that already exist. So if by pitting ourselves against each other, we just increase the polarization. In fact, there's even a social science study, Riley, you probably remember who it was by, that showed that arguing about climate change just further entrenches people's disagreement with the science. More than one, he says. Yes. So there was a study a couple months ago by some UK researchers looking at Twitter. And they had a vaguely reproachful tone to their conclusions. They said, those climate scientists are not interacting with people who criticize them on Twitter. And the implication was, well, they really should be, because that's how we change minds. Yeah, I have news. No, you don't change minds with like 160 characters on Twitter. You don't. You don't engage with the back and forth fighting, because that actually makes things worse. So my rule of thumb is, which occasionally I break, because, you know, what is a rule of thumb if you can't break it sometimes? But my general rule of thumb is, if you can't engage in a positive way, then don't, because it's not going to help. So if I know this is really hard, but if we can always be looking for those positive ways to engage, that's when we can somehow diffuse some of the polarization and actually talk rather than butting heads, and easier said than done. But there's many, many good organizations and many great media outlets that do that very effectively.
Nancy, I saw your hand was up, and I'm right behind you.
So this is probably a question for Catherine. You mentioned every year lost is a year we can't get back. What's your sense of how much time we have left, and can you put that in the context of the Paris talks?
Yes, that was talked about this morning in the plenary, too. We climate scientists are always being asked, how much is too much? When is it too late? So if you open Scientific American, there's an article on 2035 being the last year at which we can make a difference. If you talk to 350, they have a number of tons of carbon that have to be left in the ground. If we go one ton over, we're all screwed. So you can get years, you can get tons of carbon, you can get CO2 levels, you can get global temperature change amounts. But the real issue is this. Can anybody tell us exactly how many cigarettes we can smoke before we risk getting lung cancer? I don't think anybody can. We can tell you absolutely for sure without a question that the more cigarettes we smoke, the greater the risks, right? That is the exact same analogy for carbon. It's because we can tell, we scientists can certainly calculate, if we burn this much carbon, here is the likely range of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. We can then further say, if those are the levels of carbon dioxide, here's the likely temperature change. And then we can say, for a given temperature change, here are the likely impacts on health, water, food, ecosystems, society, infrastructure, and so on. We can do that. But what's dangerous? That's not a head decision, that's a heart decision. People's perception of dangerous varies radically, depending on who you are, where you live, and what's important to you. So how much is too much? There is no answer to that, because it depends on what we care about, not just what the science says, but we can say one thing for sure, and that is every ton of carbon we burn increases the risk.
Great. If everybody's real fast, we can make this the second to last question.
Riley had a comment.
Oh, Riley, okay, sorry.
Go ahead. No, I can pass.
Okay. Jeff DeBelko, Ohio University, and I think in the context of this conversation, also relevant working group 2, fifth assessment, IPCC, and a social scientist. So two things. One, it strikes me that a lot of the questions had the same problem that Riley, I think, correctly diagnosed for what the natural scientists would like the social scientists to do. Is how can we better communicate this issue? Please help us, because you understand politics or people a little. So in that sense, too, the journalists asking questions like, what can social scientists bring to the table, and understanding that the natural scientists can't do, is different than how do we navigate the best advocacy strategy or evaluation of those strategies. The second would be, while kind of fully embracing and endorsing the analysis that we heard, there are a lot of social scientists on the IPCC, and that analysis of who and what fields. In my chapter, it was mostly geographers, but also anthropologists and political scientists. And that literature that we looked at was broadly construed. I'd also kind of, again, put it back, whether it's what the funding and NSF, and I think those problems are exactly right, what NSF wants, what politicians want, and then I would ask as a question to the journalists, what you want often are privileging the natural science methods. Because back to Catherine's original point, that it's not Freudian slip about hard science and soft science, or because it's really, we do science and you social folks don't. And that's an interesting debate, but if that's the perspective that we all come to this with, then by definition we're going to privilege covering that and not look to the benefits. And if you guys demand it more on the social science side, then maybe we can raise the profile, the resources, and the impact of that work.
So I didn't hear a question. I'm going to assume you said what you wanted to say. Okay, that's the last, that is the end. I would love to hear. Big round of applause for our great panel.